Welcome back, everyone. This is the Bless You Boys podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Day. With me tonight is Ashley McLennan. Ashley, how we doing?
We are doing pretty good. It's the new year. I have not fallen off the cart of all of my resolutions, so that's a start.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah. Yep, here we are. It's kind of hard to believe, but yeah, we're really only about a month from pitchers and catchers reporting now, so we've made it after a long winter slumber where we took, you know, about 2 months off here. But fortunately, the Tigers have indulged us by not really doing a whole lot of anything. So, there wasn't a whole lot to catch up on. But it does feel like, I mean, if we're looking through Twitter over the last couple hours, and we're recording here on Monday night, Martin Luther King Day, finally things are starting to happen, it seems like. Like, this has to happen at some point. Like, we haven't had any of the big free agents sign yet. We've still got Trevor Bauer out there. We got George Springer, JT Realmuto, Marcell Ozuna, like all these dudes are still waiting for a contract, and here we are, like past the middle of January. But it does feel like it's starting to break loose, I think.
It seems like the hot stove is warming up, and I think it really did kick off with DJ LeMahieu signing back with the Yankees. He was one of those major pieces that people were really waiting for, and for him to sign what I think is a slightly too big, too long deal for a guy his age. But that's the Yankees. I think really did kind of kickstart things. So yeah, we're waiting for, you know, guys like Springer. I think Realmuto is going to stay in place with the Phillies. I think they're really gunning for him, and like his teammates are gunning for him. Like I've never seen before. I've never seen a team rally so hard to have a player stay.
Yeah, and they just really started going all in, like, 2 years ago, and haven't gotten anywhere yet, and they hired Dave Dombrowski to take over as GM this offseason, so that was pretty much a clear signal to anybody that they weren't going to sell and start rebuilding their farm system. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense that JT Realmuto has got to be the guy for them, you would think. And then...
he's the most obvious choice. I mean, there's not a lot of guys left on the market when you've got, like, you know, Alex Avila and...
yeah.
I don't know
who else. Jason Castro again, and...
yeah. Drew Butera's signed, Kurt Suzuki is signed, so I mean,
yeah,
there's not a lot of options left out there.
Yeah, I think, like, yeah, maybe Wilson Ramos is out there. It's the same three guys, like, every year on one-year deals. Like, they're just, you know, somebody's got to get in there and get one of them.
Contreras is still waiting for a potential move, eh? Like, that one's been kind of whispered about, so that would be an interesting thing to watch for, too.
Yeah, the Cubs haven't really, like, totally tore everything down, but after you trade Yu Darvish, it's, you know, it kind of feels like they're heading in that direction. But they also traded Victor Caratini, who theoretically would be the guy, although obviously he's Yu Darvish's personal catcher. But
yeah, exactly. Like, he's got to go the way of Darvish. Like, there's not really any way around that.
Yeah.
Unless they wanted to be real pricks about it. But I think that's got to be built into his contract somehow, is that, like, where Yu goes, so goes Victor. So I think that would be a fascinating contract to read if that's really in there.
That would be hilarious if there were more, like, yeah, this is my best friend contracts, where it was like, you could only take the two guys or forget it.
R.A. Dickey had that situation, didn't he? He had a catcher who was just, like, his guy, whose name, of course, is escaping me right now.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, you know, and Clayton Kershaw for a long time had, you know, one catcher he wanted. You know, he wanted A.J. Ellis, I think, only for a certain amount of time. So it does come up that way, yeah.
It was Josh Tolley who was R.A. Dickey's. And that makes sense, too, because for a knuckleballer, you got to have a guy who can actually catch.
Yeah, and probably the other guy. Yeah, the other guy in the team didn't want to catch R.A. Dickey anyway. He was fine with it. Yeah. So, yeah, just today, like, we've seen, like, Tyler Chatwood signed with the Blue Jays. Tyler Chatwood is everybody's favorite, like, but the stuff is so good guy who never has a good season, but is always, like, signing these somewhat exorbitant contracts just because the raw metrics on his stuff are so good. He's a... I don't know, not a casualty, I guess a beneficiary of the pitch data era, but no team has been really the big beneficiary of signing him. And then who else signed today? There was somebody else.
There's kind of been a couple. I've been getting pings all day from the Hug Watch channel.
Yeah.
Ben's been working hard.
Yeah, he is.
What else do we got? Yeah, Chatwood was one. Alex Colomé switched agents. That was one.
Oh, John Lester. That's the one. John Lester signed with the Washington Nationals
The
on a 1 year.
Nationals, yeah. So I guess they're probably not bringing Anibal back. He had a pitching showcase just today, I think, which is kind of interesting. And the Tigers were there, and I'm sure people are already writing their ragey comments at me for even suggesting the Tigers and Anibal Sanchez in the same sentence. But please let us remember he was on a World Series winning team and actually improved when he left the Tigers miraculously. That said, he's also older now, to be polite, and I think would be a very risky pickup for them, even on a reclamation project. So I do kind of want to see if the Rays are sniffing, though, because that would be an interesting 1 year contract for them.
Yeah, and he's not really the type. He's not really like a Rays type pitcher in some ways, but I don't know. I could kind of see that. And I mean, and it's just a matter of I feel like whenever we're writing about Tigers free agent targets, it's like you have the dream list, and then you have the like, okay, maybe they'll get one of these guys, and then there's the okay, here's all the bargain basement guys, and this is kind of what we have to pick through. So by the time people are listening to this podcast, I'll probably have something up on Matt Shoemaker, who's another one who is kind of perennially injured. Occasionally, when he's healthy, he's usually still pretty effective. Kind of has some like seam shifty type traits and throws a ton of splitters, which the Tigers have kind of seemed to be leaning toward in recent years. So he's another one who like maybe wouldn't be the guy that we'd really love, but the Tigers are, we do have like so many, we have many pitchers. We just don't have enough like innings probably out of them. So if they sign a guy like Garrett Richards, who is the one I would like, or Matt Shoemaker, and they end up being hurt and only making 10 starts, I mean, it's fine because it just opens up, the spot for Casey Mize, Tarek Skubal, Matt Manning, whoever else to come up and get a shot. So it's just kind of like a matter of having enough kind of warm bodies around who could be, decent at least, I suppose.
So if
So,
somebody's arm falls off,
yeah.
you have somebody else to slot
Yeah, exactly. Next
the
man up.
Tigers way. I think, what was it, like 2 years ago, they had the potential for about seven starting pitchers, and by the end of the season, I think they had three.
Well, and even last spring, I think I wrote that a whole thing about like, the Tigers do have a ton of pitching depth this year, which might help them out. We don't have anybody great, but we had, you still had Zimmerman sitting around, of course, and they had signed Ivan Nova, and then you had Fulmer, Boyd, you had Turnbull, and you had Mize and Skubal possibly coming up. You had Tyler Alexander and Daniel Norris, and we still have most of those guys. We swapped out Ivan Nova for what's his face, Jose Urania. So he's in there now. So I mean, they've got a lot of pitching, but yeah, just with the fact that the young pitchers especially are going to really have strict innings limits this year, and teams are talking about maybe using six-man rotations part of the time because guys didn't get enough work last year and they're scared they're going to hurt all the pitchers this year. Kind of makes sense to pick up some backup. I just wish, yeah, that the Tigers would go for a little bit bigger game than Matt Shoemaker or Anibal Sanchez or something like that. But we know what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, I think the big concern is going from a season where your minor league guys barely played, except for the alternate sites, where you had a 60-game season where nobody really got a chance to like warm up or stretch out. And now, you got the commissioner's office saying they want to aim for 162 games. They want to aim for spring training to start, mid-Feb as it normally does. And part of me thinks they might actually pull off the timing, because they were able to pull off that 60-game season with, I mean, obviously, quite a lot of disaster at the beginning. I don't know how they actually managed to get through the whole thing. But I think they've learned some lessons, maybe. The fact, of course, that spring training takes place in Florida and Arizona, which are two of the, I think, two of the highest caseload states right now, are not helpful.
Yep, this is true. But again, like you can kind of, especially if they keep the minor leaguers back and don't have camp for them until April, you can probably kind of isolate the group, and and I mean, I think we all know how this is going to go too. Like, vaccine rollout has been kind of garbage so far, but it's going to get ramped up pretty fast here, I'm assuming. And somehow, wealthy sports teams all seem to manage to get super high-end medical care that the average folks can't get. So there's probably a pretty good chance that most of those guys will be vaccinated by then, and we'll see. But yeah, one way or the other, we don't know for sure, but they're definitely telling them to plan for a normal major league season. The attendance might be the thing that's still kind of up in the
Well,
air as far as that goes, but we'll see.
I think, yeah, spring training attendance I still think is a terrible idea, even though I think that they're aiming to be able to sell pods of tickets. I think where it becomes, I feel like the way we're seeing, it depends state by state too, right? Obviously, local legislation will restrict things a lot more. Like, I can see things being okay in maybe like, and this is just me pulling a state out because I don't know what the caseload numbers are in like the Midwest, but like maybe it's easier to have a crowd in Cincinnati than it is somewhere like Los Angeles, where things are so bad that they're having to like ease restrictions on like air pollution so that they can cremate more people. Like it's very different situation state to state, and I think the lowest worry for anybody should be getting people into baseball games. But obviously, you also, if you're going to do it, you want to be able to do it safely. And I think that that's what they're trying to assess. They're like, how do we sell these pods of seats? How do we, enforce mask mandates? They've said stuff like that they're not going to do or to require showing a negative test. They're not going to require people to show proof of vaccine. I mean, which I guess is like, that's a legal thing you don't want to step your feet into, to like be asking people about their medical history. But it does puts things at risk, right? Like, so
It does.
there's a lot of questions.
I mean, there really are. I mean, I could see them being able to manage, even under like current conditions, like managing, like quarter crowd size. I mean,
Yeah, like a 20% capacity, I think you could do it.
20 to 30 maybe at least, and maybe they can do more depending, again, just depending on how, how fast the population is getting vaccinated. But again, you are outside. I mean, there's obviously plenty of risk of transmission kind of no matter what, but when you're at an outdoor event, like it's less than when you're in an enclosed space with people for a long amount of time. So I don't know, I'm sure they're trying to factor all these things in. And I'm glad I'm not in charge of having to do that, because you have to imagine, like, on one hand, the pressure from the owners has got to just be insane, because apart from worrying about their PR, they want their money, and that's all that they want. And meanwhile, like, yeah, the league has got to kind of try to manage this so that it's not like a completely irresponsible shit show, to put it bluntly. And enjoy, good luck with all that. Let's
My personal favorite, as a fellow from a Tiger but also a Rays fan, is that people are already making attendance jokes, because it's like the Rays will be allowing 7,000 people to attend games.
just.
We're like, oh, so back to normal then? And I'm like, yep, it's hilarious.
Thanks, guys. Yep, full capacity for the Rays. Ha ha ha.
Hilarious.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much full capacity for the Tigers these days. So, no one around in these parts can talk either, I'm afraid.
I think the thing that we don't really talk about when it comes to fan attendance, though, is like the impact it actually does have on the players. Because I think that that was the feedback that we were seeing from everybody playing those games, is how incredibly strange it was for the piped in crowd noise, or to not see fans in the stadium and to not get that reinforcement during gameplay. Like, I don't think anybody realized quite how psychologically it affected the players in the field to not have fans around, which I think is kind of a fascinating case study.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of speculated that it would be, that it was going to be pretty weird, and a lot of guys made their debut, like this big moment where you'd usually have your family there, and the adrenaline would be racing, and instead, it kind of felt like they were just playing like a scrimmage game, some of the time. Seemed like it took until, September, when all of a sudden there's the playoffs and stuff starting to feel like it's on the line, before like the real intensity was able to kick in like normal. So, and even then, I mean, it was still just weird. It was a weird watch. I never, you I mean you appreciate what the crowd noise would be like, and they tried to like pipe in some kind of fake noise and stuff, but it was just so odd. The sounds in the stadium just aren't the same. The sound off the bat in some stadiums sounded like gunshots going off, which was kind of impressive in some ways, but then other sounds would be more muted in different parks. It was just weird to like listen to the game in an empty ballpark and hear the differences was strange too. Yeah, the whole thing was weird. It was just a bizarre season. But it's a whole new chapter. Whatever happens as far as old Corona goes, it's a new chapter for the Tigers because we haven't had a chance to talk about this between you and I since the last time we were on the podcast. I had Mark on a couple times and we talked about some of these things, but the Tigers have a new head honcho in AJ Hinch. It's a whole new coaching staff. It's pretty exciting. It's a little bit sad to say that this might be the most exciting thing that has happened over the past like 4 seasons, other than maybe when Tyler Alexander went nuts and struck out 9 batters in a row and we were all like, "Oh, what's happening? Something's happening."
What is going on here?
Nope.
Yeah, I got to admit, I was one of those people that was a little bit like, "Eh," on the Hinch hiring on the offset, only because I feel like the kind of the taint of the Astro scandal hasn't worn off entirely. High five to the one person listening to this that giggled when I said taint. Congrats. Yeah, I think the part of me was just like, "Oh, I don't know." But then, you know, the logical baseball part of my brain was like, "This guy's really good, and he managed a World Series team, and he's an incredible asset to be able to take and like utilize, and kind of the exact guy you want to kind of bring in the end of the Gardy era," which I think was just very much a holdover.
Yeah.
Gardy's the guy you want to kind of like steer the ship while the young guys are getting ready. But Hinch is exactly the kind of guy you want to have when that ship is ready to like sail. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm
Start.
excited. I'm cautiously optimistic. I think it's been long enough and like the short enough season of last year and all the other stuff that's happened since that I don't think anybody's going to be going, "Ah, you're a cheater," and like banging trash cans at him. So
Yeah, I mean,
Chris Sutter is by far my more exciting pickup, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of that is probably going to happen, and maybe before the season starts, I'll write a thing about the Astros scandal and kind of, you know, there were a lot of really good articles written about, you know, actually how effective the cheating scandal appeared to be, which ultimately wasn't that much because they got the signals wrong so often that it was, you know, it was screwing them up. So it's kind of interesting to see how that played out. But I think what kind of sells me is just the fact that baseball doesn't seem to have any kind of problem with AJ Hinch. Like the real contentiousness seems to be between, you know, like Joe Kelly versus like Carlos Correa. You know, like it seems like the anger out there is like player to player.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you talk to managers and GMs and they all still rave about AJ Hinch and what a great guy he is and how they like him, you know, and how smart he is and blah blah blah. And there's just that disconnect where, yeah, you know, for a certain segment of the fan base, it's like, "You're a cheater and you'll always be a cheater," and you
Yeah,
know, but the game itself doesn't seem to care. It's weird.
I think the person coming away from this with the big C scarlet letter is going to be Jeff Luhnow. I don't think that at the end of the day, Alex Cora or AJ Hinch or those guys who were part of that on the level that they just didn't stop it are going to have quite the pall over them that Jeff Luhnow does. I don't think he's ever going to work in baseball again, to be quite frank.
No, I believe he bought a soccer team in Mexico, I believe, and
Well,
that is what he has gone off to do now.
all the best to him, because I don't want him anywhere near Major League
No,
Baseball.
I don't. Because it went, I mean, there was so much that went on just in the
Well, he was a huge
culture.
part of like trying to bury the Stephanie Abstein story about what happened in the locker room with the female reporter, and like there's just, you know, so much that he had his fingers in that was really like ugly.
And
And
it
I
just
think
seemed
that
to permeate like the entire, you know, front office and everything. Like, you know, there was just, yeah. The whole attitude of that organization just seemed to be bad in the management levels. So yeah, good riddance really. But yeah, so you know, I mean, AJ Hinch is already getting, you know, name checked when the Tigers sign people. He gives the Tigers, and I guess this is the whole thing. Like we all hope that AJ Hinch does a great job as a coach and can raise up the young players, and you know. Obviously, the Tigers have a big catching problem and nothing there. And AJ Hinch is a great catching coach. So you would hope that maybe he can get something out of Rodgers, you know, maybe help them with developing Dylan Dingler and that sort of thing. But he also just sort of gives you that name recognition, like to go play for AJ Hinch for pitchers to go work with Chris Fetter, who, you know, was a pretty highly sought after, you know, pitching coach who didn't seem to really want to leave U of M, and we weren't really sure that we could get him. And then all of a sudden, you know, just bam, overnight, it was like, oh, Chris Fetter's coming here. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't really be more excited about anything this offseason, unless the Tigers just stagger us with a trade or something. Then to get Chris Fetter and AJ Hinch in there, and to finally feel like you've got like cutting edge coaches who are, you know, young and hungry and have something to prove, and you know, are
new ideas and like want to try exciting different things.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm super enthused about that.
Yep. Yeah, and I think they did the right thing in bringing up Juan Nieves, who was the AAA pitching coach for the Tigers for a couple years. Did really nice work, like kind of tuning a couple guys right before they got to the major leagues, like Spencer Turnbull, Tyler Alexander. Like both of those guys just seemed to get just marginally better in a lot of small things when they worked with him, and you know, were kind of noticeably better when they actually did get to the major leagues than they'd been kind of even just like a year earlier in the minors. So, and Juan Nieves has been a major league pitching coach. He was a pitching coach with the Marlins. So he's got that major league experience that kind of helps balance the fact that Fetter has, you know, worked in the major leagues, but has never coached at the major league level. So that seemed like a smart move. Everybody seems to love George Lombard and think, you know, he's like great management material. So he's in as bench coach. We've got a new hitting coach. The Tigers revamped their player development system all last year, and we didn't really get to see any of the results of them hiring Kenny Graham and Dan Hubbs and Georgia Giblin to do the sports science department. We didn't really get to see any of that because they didn't get to work with the players much this year. But, you know, but again, because they didn't, it's almost like we just got them. And so there's this whole new influx of energy and, you know, young, innovative minds working with the players this year. And so, yeah, I mean, we've got to hope that this can finally get the development machine cranking here, because it's really been pretty grim. I mean, it was nice to see Casey Mize and Tarek Skubal, and nice to see Paredes, and, you know, the fact that Willie Castro got pretty hot for a little while was encouraging, but by and large,
see that, like, because they did the same thing with Jose de Leon, right? Like, they saw a guy that had a lot of, like, interest. I mean, obviously, Jose de Leon wasn't as highly ranked as Mize was when the Tigers picked him up, but it's knowing and seeing if you think there's going to be a decline before the decline actually happens. And of course, right now, we've seen one very tiny part of a season with Casey Mize where he struggled. I don't think that's enough to say that Casey Mize isn't going to make it.
The best time to trade him might have been last spring then, you know, before anybody had even seen him at the major league level, you know, when he was the number one prospect in baseball. But yeah, I'm not sure. Well,
he'll become the next Justin Verlander. So, I mean, like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, yeah. And of course, it's not a question of, like, wanting to get rid of Casey Mize. It's just a question of, like, you know, like the Rays do, getting the most value, you know, out of the guys that you have, one way or the other, and knowing which guys aren't going to work out before anyone else does. And that's the thing we keep harping on, like with like the Kristen Stewart situation. Yeah. Like 2 years ago, Kristen Stewart was a decent trade chip. The best teams would recognize that, we don't really, let's see if we can ship him out for something now, you know, rather than just trying these guys at the major league level over and over again, you know, and letting them fail. Dowell Lugo was another one.
And I think that's such a huge problem for the Tigers that I don't think they know how they want to rebuild, because they seem to just be hoarding their prospects. And yeah, they've got some good prospects, but there comes a point when you're on year, what are we now, almost year five of this rebuild.
Yeah.
And you have to look at it and say, okay, like, when do we move them to the majors, or when do we assess that they're not going to fit what we're trying to do with our team and trade them for like a guy who's borderline AAA to MLB level, and see if we can get guys that are ready to compete now, pick up a few free agents, and actually like make a go of it. And I think that the problem is they seem to be stuck in this position where they really want to develop their entire future roster of winners.
Yeah.
But that's not how you build a winning team. You don't do it all from within. You have to pick pieces up from other places and trade compete and pick up via free agency. It's like a, it's a three bucket system.
Yep.
And the Tigers are very stuck in one bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the more cynical interpretation of that, which I ascribe to a lot of the time, is that the Tigers just don't want to put themselves in a position where there are any expectations. Like, they don't, you know, once you start trying, you know, then you can be graded on whether or not you're failing. But when you just kind of stay in this, well, you know, we're still just kind of, you know, building up the farm system and starting to piece things together, you know, you keep expectations away from it. And yeah, I mean, all right, it's, we're going into year four of the rebuild. But that's still a long time to be the worst team in baseball. Like, it's not like there's been any building yet. This is still, you know, ground floor stuff, even though the farm system is obviously much better. So, yeah, we've got a long way to go. And I don't know, I've said this before too, it just scares me to death when a team won't trade their prospects and doesn't just generally make trades very aggressively, because it tells me they just don't think that they can out-evaluate other teams, even in regards to their own players. You know, they don't think they know their guys and what they're worth better than other teams that are out there. And yeah, I mean,
or they overvalue them and they don't genuinely, I think, actually assess or look at the trades they're being offered. I think that maybe they look at it and they're like, okay, like, I'll trade you Casey Mize, but you have to give me three of your best top prospects. And other teams are like, yeah, that's not going to happen, but thank you.
Right.
And, like, I think that there's maybe a habit on their end of highly overestimating the value of some of the guys on their team or that are in their minor league system. And I think that they would benefit from, like, a real analytics type to have a look at those offers and be like, hey, this is actually not so bad. Maybe you should take a look at this.
Yeah, and I can almost feel myself thinking that AJ Hinch might end up having more of a hand in that. You know, Jim Leland had a little bit more of a hand in things just because of who he was and because of the timing of Jim Leland coming here and where the system was and the fact that, okay, it was time to go. They were supposed to be getting better. And so Jim Leland had, you know, quite a bit of say in his roster. And of course he was a veteran and they brought him here to win. The same is true of AJ Hinch. You know, AJ Hinch is not Jim Leland, but, you know, has that experience and is the type of guy who I think a lot of people expect to ultimately become a GM someday if that's what he wants to do. So you hope that, yeah, maybe he has a little bit of input there. But yeah, I mean, to go right back to, 2017, when they tore things down, they kept Michael Fulmer and, you know, they kept Matt Boyd and they kept Daniel Norris. And at the time, that led me to think that, okay, they're not going to take forever here because, you know, if they were, why wouldn't they deal those guys then? You know, and obviously there's a lot of speculation about what they were offered and, you know, whether or not it was good enough. Obviously, in retrospect, they should have traded all three of them then for whatever the best offer was and just started gone 100% into, okay, we're rebuilding this thing and tearing it all the way down. They didn't do that. And now we've got these three guys who Daniel Norris is going to be a free agent after this year. Fulmer and Boyd are coming up the year after. And right now, none of them is worth much of anything. Like, Norris is probably worth a decent chunk because he's a good reliever. He's a lefty. He can go multiple innings. But yeah, Boyd and Fulmer are really, you know, absolutely worthless right now.
To beat the dead trade horse, I really want Norris to go to the Rays. I think he would be such a good fit for their model.
Yeah, I mean, he's a total Rays guy. You know, he's the high spin, you know, high spin efficiency guy with the nasty breaking ball, and, you know, kind of will pitch in any situation.
And you're not going to get much for him because of the limited, you know, term of his contract. But I think that you could still, the Tigers aren't going to do anything with him. So what's the point? Like, see if you can get something interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if it was me, I'd be thinking about extending Daniel Norris up here. But but they don't show any signs of doing that. Daniel Norris agreed, you know, to an ARB deal. That's all locked in. And so he's going to get traded in July, assuming he's healthy. And, you know, if he pitches like he did last year, we'll probably have the same value as like Shane Green had a couple years ago. So maybe we'll get a nice but not special pitching prospect for him or something like that, which would be fine. But yeah, it's just, you think about like the last 3 years while all three of those guys have sort of, you know, struggled and gone up and down and dealt with injuries and all this kind of stuff. And, yeah, now it's just at the point where we're kind of just going to be giving them away for whatever we can get, which is a drag. So
it would have been nice to move Boyd too.
Did not work out.
Too bad.
Yeah. So now what we're left is to, to hope that Chris Vetter has some tricks up his sleeves for those guys and, can kind of maximize whatever value they have left and, and get us some prospects back or a player. But yeah, it's not been ideal at any point along the rebuild. When we have to keep pointing back to the fact that they made one good trade in 2017, like it wasn't a complete disaster because they got, Jamer Candelario and, it's not ideal. So, but I think we all know that we're hoping that a whole bunch of players who we didn't get to see this year in the farm system, guys like Parker Meadows or Bryant Packard, like some of these guys, took a step forward in their training and everything. And, we'll see it this year, but yeah, I mean, the Tigers need some of those mid-tier prospects to break and start doing better. Cody Clemens, somebody needs to make a move. Help this thing out.
Yeah. I'm still mystified by the whole Jake Rogers thing. I really just wish I understood what his failures were. And maybe there aren't, I don't know, but like what's keeping him or kept him from being used at all. And what keeps him from being discussed in any capacity as the Tigers' future everyday catcher? Like, clearly they've just let go of that.
Yeah, I mean, the only person who I've seen, really reference that is A.J. Hinch. And it sounds like A.J. Hinch, wants him to get a chance. So, maybe things will change this year. But it's just bizarre when you have a, Grayson Griner play for 2 years, putting up like a 30 or a 40 WRC plus, not doing anything particularly good behind the plate. Like, he's fine. He's a fine defensive catcher. If he could hit, I'd be perfectly happy with him as a backup. But, Jake Rogers changed his swing last offseason, went to, one of the best independent hitting coaches that's out there, Doug Latta, who's, kind of turned around the careers of quite a few people, and tried to do the right thing, tried to do what the Tigers seem to want him to do, which is to make more contact, hit more line drives, not swing for the fences. It was like he just kind of got shunted aside. And so you have to assume from that it wasn't going particularly well. There isn't any other reason. Like, I've seen a couple articles that speculated that the Tigers were gaming his service time or some nonsense, but, that didn't have anything to do with it because Jake Rogers is already, I think, 26. It's like,
yeah,
it's not a service time issue.
This year has been especially interesting to think of gaming service time because I look at the Cubs with Chris Bryant and they got sued over gaining his service time, and that suit was really over this coming year.
Yep.
And now they're talking about trading him. Like, he's not the former Chris Bryant, and I think about that every time I hear stories about gaming service time now, because I'm like, why bother? Like, why not get that major league time out of a young player while you still can? And the back end of a player's contract is almost never where you want them anyway. So,
yeah,
I mean, there's obviously exceptions to that. There's, when you got a guy and he's only contracted till 28 and he becomes Miguel Cabrera, obviously it's a different story, but.
Right. Yeah. It just hasn't really gone that well for Chris Bryant the past couple of years. Like, still a good player, but, hasn't really kind of maintained that early production and turned out to be a great player. But yeah, it is interesting to think that this is the year that they kind of stole from him by slow playing him for a month or whatever it was. Who knows if they had him that month back then, maybe that season would have gone differently. You really don't know. But that whole gaming the service time thing continues to sort of linger over the whole league. And, with the next CBA going to be negotiated next year, There's a lot of talk about how to, get the younger players paid more so that the veterans will get, paid in free agency and teams won't just like immediately throw all the veterans out and go cheap every year with their youngest guys. And yeah, it's all of a parcel, and I'm sure that'll be a topic that comes up a lot this year as the no doubt contentious relations between league and players union continue to unfold. So yeah.
Well, I would love it if they could just decide on universal DH before they really start, fighting each other to the death for things.
Yeah, they still. Yeah, it keeps. It's like the. Well, it's kind of like the 162 game season. Like, they keep coming out with these fairly declarative statements. Like, we're telling all the teams to be ready. We're gonna have a full schedule. Pending maybe some changes. And it was, you know, and then it was like, we're not going to have the universal DH. And now it's back to, well, maybe we will have the universal DH, but, you know, we want something for it and we're going to negotiate about it. It's just so bizarre to. I suppose football probably is like this every year where there's like these rule changes that happen beforehand. But to have the actual structure of, you know, of the game still kind of under debate, you know, with like a month until pitchers and catchers report is just, it's just odd to me. This feels like they keep pushing the decision making off later and later every year, just in the same way that free agency kind of keeps getting pushed, you know, further and further back. Free agency this year, I mean, it made sense that it would take a while because teams wanted to, you know, get some confidence that there'd be a regular season and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we understand why this one is taking so long in particular, but yeah, to see like almost none of the top prospects, you know, signed yet, and even, you know, not even like, you know, huge rumors going around about a lot of them. And meanwhile, the Padres are out here just, you know, punching everyone in the face and picking up every good player possible. It's amazing.
They're signing fucking everybody, and they're still like, you know, we might still be interested in Trevor Bauer. We might still be interested in Sonny Gray. I don't know, like, who else you got? You want to trade for somebody? Can I have Justin Verlander when he comes back from Tommy John? We'll take him too. Like, why not?
Yep.
Like, everybody to the
I
Padres.
know. Those bastards better not do that. You just leave your filthy paws off of Justin Verlander right now.
I still want that final outcome where it's he comes back from Tommy John, he decides to play one or two more seasons, and he does it in Detroit. That's all I want.
Yep.
Give me the romantic conclusion to his career.
Yeah, if I'm gonna go full romantic, it's Justin Verlander at age, you know, 41 on the field after the Tigers win a World Series.
Tip in the cap, like just walking back to the dugout. Oh God, I want to cry.
Yep. The celebration, Kate Upton on the field,
Everybody
their
on the
cute little daughter on his
field.
shoulders, like it's all come full circle. Yeah.
Oh,
We're just breaking hearts out there.
the tears I would have. Like, I still cry watching like clips from 2006, so
Yeah.
I feel like I could get a good tearjerker going just imagining this outcome.
Yep. Oh man. Yeah, that does sound pretty good. Yeah, I mean that tells you how bad the injuries were this year. Justin Verlander like had an arm injury after f 15 years, basically. It
And only
was
like a couple
ridiculous.
games into the season too, so it was pretty rough.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
that goes to show you how bad it is if they don't have the right opportunity to like prepare.
Yep. I mean, you just never know. Like for him, it may have just been coming all this time, and whatever super freak UCL he has in that elbow just finally was like, no, I need a little work done. But can't throw this hard for this long forever. But yeah, that dream is definitely in my mind as well. But for now, the dream is to be a Padres fan, and they went out again today and traded for Joe Musgrove to add another like decent arm to that rotation, which for everyone's fantasy baseball team purposes out there, immediately made everyone think that Dinelson Lamet must be injured because they already had enough pitching. I don't know if that's true, but yeah, I mean, you look at the guys they even have on the shelf. You know, they got Mike Clevinger who isn't going to pitch this year. They've got people back.
I just envision the Padres being like pitcher Pokemon catchers. Like, it's gotta catch them all.
Yep.
You need a little bit of everybody to fill in all those roles.
Yep. They're just picking up pitchers left and right. And meanwhile, Corey Kluber went and signed with the Yankees on a 1-year deal. So that happened the other day. So he's over there now and coming
That
back from
was,
injury. So we'll
what, like
see.
11 million? That was actually surprising. Like,
Yeah, I think with incentives, yeah, 11 million. Like, yeah, he actually got pretty good money, and we didn't really get like a whole lot of reports out of his workout. Like, it sounded like he was, you know, throwing 90, 91. You know, the stuff looked pretty good, and I guess it's fairly normal to not, you know, to not have full velocity, obviously, right yet. You're still building toward that in February, and into March. So I guess that's normal. But yeah, I mean, considering the Yankees were all screaming about their luxury tax problems, you know, they went ahead and did that, and then they signed DJ LeMahieu to like a 6-year, $90 million deal, which is weird for a player who's, I think, already 33 or 32 at least. So yeah, I don't know. It's been funky. And meanwhile, like all the big tier guys are out there, and there's still, you know, kind of a ton of veteran, kind of pick your poison type pitchers who are all going to get 1 year. Three, four, five, $6 million or something like that. So there's going to be a lot of that kind of filler move left around. But yeah, as we talked about with catcher too, like there's like three, you know, halfway decent. Okay, this guy is, you know, your backup catcher, your backup veteran catcher for the year. And the Tigers need to get one of those guys. I don't know if we have to, you know, write this article every single offseason, but, you know, at some point the Tigers have to address the goddamn catcher position.
They do, and they do every year. This becomes a problem, and I think you and I have both extensively written about this over the last 3 years. And once again, I know you're writing something about it, but like, I'm going to write the standard annual imploring speech to bring Alex Avila back because dude's still only like what 31 or 32.
Yep.
Like, he's not an everyday catcher, but he's an absolute gem to have in your platoon and a great guy to have behind the plate when you've got your Matt Mannings and your Casey Mizes and your Tarek Skubals out there.
Yeah. And that's our main concern, you know. If you're going to bring up Jake Rogers, yeah, Jake Rogers is good defensively, but he still doesn't have that experience and that sort of clout and know-how for bringing up young pitchers. And so, yeah, I mean, Alex Avila makes the perfect sense. Alex Avila can play first base. We don't have a first baseman right now. Maybe they'll circle back and you know, bring CJ Krohn back on a cheap deal if his knee is healthy and try that. And I mean, the Tigers still seem to me, and I don't think I'm being optimistic here when I think the Tigers are probably still going to spend another $18 to $20 million. Like, I still think they're probably going to go and sign two or three more guys, just to replace the money, you know, that Jordan Zimmermann's contract coming off the books and Prince Fielder's money finally leaving. Like, I feel like they're going to spend that much. But again, that's still going to be like, you know, one or two mid-tier guys and maybe another pitcher. But
I could see them bringing CJ Krohn back. I think that would be an interesting move.
yeah, I mean, Jonathan Schoop had a great year for us too. I mean, I wouldn't mind doing that, assuming that they still want to play Willy Castro at shortstop, despite all evidence, you know, to the contrary, that he's ever going to be average or better there. But yeah, I don't know. It still seems like those things are at least possible. So we'll have to see. I really did like, you know, the Robbie Grossman signing. I wanted someone, you know, someone better. I wanted Michael Brantley. To me, that would have been ideal. But I also know that Michael Brantley probably wants to go play for a real team and try to win himself a ring before he wraps things up. And Robbie Grossman is that type of low key signing that we would like to see, like a guy whose metrics all turn in the right direction over the course of the last year or two, who has like a swing change that he made that kind of points to you know, there being a reason for it rather than luck. His defense has gotten better. He's still young enough, you know, to be around a couple years and still be in his physical prime. And he's one of those guys who it feels like never broke out and then suddenly realized one day that, like, okay, I'm 30 now and I've never had the big year that I thought I would have, and finally, like, maybe kicked it into, you know, overdrive and was much more willing to experiment and try some different things in his swing and make some changes. And it can be really hard to get guys to do that when they're successful. And sometimes it takes, you know, as we found with James McCann, it takes getting cut. And when you thought you were the man, in Detroit, and holy God, that didn't work out well for us. You know, sometimes it takes that. And we'd all wish that the coaches and the managers could get that point through to them. For whatever reason, Ron Gardenhire couldn't do that with James McCann, and you know, to the Tigers' detriment, unfortunately, because I think most of us would have still liked him around as the backup catcher. We just didn't want him catching full time, and costing the pitchers strikes. So yeah, that didn't work out too well for us. But James McCann is now a Met, and you know, that's another team. You know, the Mets and the Padres are building a new little power block between them in the National League that should be pretty interesting to see this year.
Yeah, I think it's going to be there's going to be some interesting National League baseball being played. The White Sox too are going to be, I think, an intriguing team in the American League. They've made some good moves,
Yep.
and yeah, it's
they continue to spend money and go all in. They signed Yoenis Cespedes' brother, his younger brother. Oh God, I can't pronounce his first name without seeing it right now. But yeah, they picked him up, you know, in as an international free agent. They signed Liam Hendricks to be probably their closer. They had another good draft. They picked up Garrett Crochet with their first pick, who turned out to be a left-hander throwing 100 miles an hour, that they're going to use in relief now, looking like a bigger, nastier Josh Hader. So yeah, the White Sox are a big problem. They're going to be a big problem. And even though, the Indians traded Francisco Lindor, that doesn't really help us that much. It's still looking like the White Sox and the Twins, and then maybe the Royals and Indians, and then us. So there we go.
Sorry, I'm just looking at YouTube for Yoenis Cespedes' brother, and I can't
I
tell.
want to say it's Euclid, but I can't
It's,
remember.
yeah, it looks like it's like Yoelqui, but there's two guys listed, and I can't tell if it's just two spellings, because there's Euclid and then there's Yule Kiss.
Yeah, I think they might both be Yoenis Cespedes' brothers. I think he has two brothers.
Half brother
Okay, yeah.
says, sorry, I'm just reading up on this.
Oh, no worries.
But it looks like it's Euclid. Oh my God. Euclid.
Euclid.
Yulki. I got to assume if it's Yoenis, Yulki. Oh man, I feel like an asshole for not pronouncing that right, and I'm so sorry.
It's all right, we're doing this in real time.
Yeah, so he does look like the one that the White Sox signed, but it's really interesting.
Yep, and they keep doing that. They've spent some money on some big international prospects. They were the ones who got Luis Robert, and they're gonna be reaping the rewards of that for a while. So, yeah, I mean, we have our work cut out for us, and the White Sox are the big dogs in the division now.
Yeah, they're absolutely. I mean, the Indians have done nothing to make themselves demonstrably any better, and in fact, I think have made themselves significantly worse by moving, Francisco Lindor, which is a foregone conclusion. We all saw that coming.
Yeah, they still have a good pitching staff, but
Moving Carrasco was an interesting move. I didn't see that coming.
I thought that was a good move for the Mets too, because Carrasco, has always been fairly good, and he's gone through leukemia and a bunch of injuries, and has finally seemed to kind of emerge on the far side of it healthy. And even though he's in his 30s now, he's still a pretty good pitcher. So yeah, they're stacking it up over there.
What I find interesting about that move is that he had 5 and 10, and
Yeah.
so he chose to go,
Yep.
which
Yep.
I always think is so interesting.
Yeah, that's telling.
Have the option, but you can tell. Oh boy, not to interrupt, but there's some interesting yikesy Mets news that just broke. Apparently, their GM Jared Porter sent explicit photos, including naked pictures of his little friend, to a foreign female reporter in 2016 after she ignored dozens of other messages from him for weeks.
Oh no. Oh my God.
Mets, you were having such a good off season, and then this.
Everything was going so well.
Ugh, that's gross. Don't do that. Nobody wants your unsolicited dick pics.
Yes.
Anybody. Ben, let me give you just one bit of information. Only sends them when they're solicited, my friends.
Yeah, and even then you should probably reconsider, because everything that you put
Yeah,
online.
you really want to know, do you want those out there? And I mean, consenting adults, do your thing, but
Yeah,
yeah,
but thinking.
consent is the biggest part of it. Don't send them unless anybody asks.
Yeah,
Oh,
and
God.
please also remember that the internet is forever. And Oh boy. Okay, and then yeah, like the last thing to kind of throw out in Tigers news is the fact that the Tigers did have five players placed in the top 31 on Baseball America's top 100 list. That just came out the other day. Not a whole lot of like interesting notes about the players, because of course we haven't really gotten to see a whole lot of them other than Mize and Skubal. But it is notable just in the fact that it's just so rare to have five guys that high. Usually because someone would have graduated, and Casey Mize and Tarik Skubal just came up just short of losing their prospect eligibility. And so this probably is the high watermark for the Tigers farm system for the foreseeable future, because there's a good chance that Manning debuts this year. There's an outside chance Spencer Torkelson, who checked in at the number five overall prospect in baseball, the decent chance that he will debut this year. It just depends on how things go for him. They'll probably start him out in High A, which is now the West Michigan Whitecaps, with the reorganization of the minor leagues. And so I would get over there and get your tickets to see Spencer Torkelson pretty quickly there, because odds are they're just going to keep moving him up to Erie and then to Toledo by year's end, and just see if maybe he can get a look. I guess the thing about it is that it kind of shows that how top heavy the Tiger system still is, and how we need some more of the younger guys and the ones who haven't broken through yet to fill in the gaps here. The Tigers are gonna draft high again in 2020, and they're also gonna have a second first round pick in the competitive balance round. So this is, you know, this is kind of the last, you know, big draft, assuming that they're not just gonna keep tanking for the next couple years. And so, yeah, it's just going to be such a big year for the whole organization as far as the rebuild goes, because, yeah, they've got to have the development system show some improvement and bring some of these guys along. They've got to have another big draft. We really like the 2020 draft, and there are some interesting prospects there that came up who it'll be fun to watch in the minor leagues this year. And, you know, this has kind of gotten to the point where you can't just like tank and restock forever, and the Tigers have done about as much of that as you can. So it's getting to be go time now, and we'll be interested to see what impact all the new coaches and everybody has on the guys that we already have and the ones that we're familiar with, but especially with these young guys have got to show some progress. So, you know, that's kind of going to be the story, and probably the key overall narrative for the Tigers this season is how well Chris Fetter can help some of the pitchers, and, you know, whether or not AJ Hinch has an impact, whether or not Robbie Grossman kind of turns out to be the guy that he looked like for Oakland this year, and, you know, who ends up getting traded at the deadline other than Daniel Norris. So the Tigers bullpen, I think, you know, we all saw that at least for like the first month of the season had a lot more potential in it than we'd seen in a long time. Greg Soto, Brian Garcia, Jose Cisnero, Joe Jimenez was just an afterthought and pitched badly, and they were still like a really effective unit for at least a while. They were kind of the thing that kept the Tigers in it. So hopefully the Tigers will have some trade chips coming out of that group, because if you have a reliever who is good and you are not planning on winning in the next year, you probably should deal them. So,
yeah, it's going to be an interesting year.
Yep. So we'll be looking for those guys. And yeah, I don't know. I think that about wraps it up for this episode as far as baseball goes. And I don't know, we get in a habit sometimes of like, you know, kind of like over-promising on how many podcasts we're going to do. So I'm not going to do that, but we probably will be back within 2 weeks or so. And I'm going to try to have some other guests on. I wrote an article about Seam Shifted Wake that probably a lot of you saw on the site, and I'd like to get someone else on to talk about that. Maybe one of the guys from Pitcher's List, or possibly if I can talk Dr. Smith, Professor Barton Smith, or maybe even if I could get Rob Friedman on here, that would be super fun to get the Pitching Ninja on. It's a busy time of year, so you never know who you can get as far as guests go, but I will try to do something along those lines as well. So you can look forward to that. And I think at this point you can probably check out if you're here for baseball, because for the most part we're going to talk about Anya Taylor-Joy and the Queen's Gambit and our mutual obsession over said person from here to the rest out. So thanks for joining us. If you want to stick around for the next half hour of us just absolutely simping over this girl, feel free. Yeah.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prof G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday, and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So, yeah, I mean, Anya Taylor-Joy, I saw in The Witch like 4 or 5 years ago, 2015.
I only saw it for the first time this past Halloween. I don't know what had taken me so long, because I saw The Lighthouse, which is his other one.
Yeah, and, director Robert Eggers, if people aren't familiar with The Lighthouse and The Witch.
He's a little weirdo. I love his stuff. Like, it's so... It's not really horror, but
yeah.
It is.
Yeah, it's like more Hitchcocky and like psychological suspense, but it's like but gritty. He described them as like nightmares of people who've already died. You know, that was kind of how he described it, like nightmares from the past. And that kind of suits it. They have like this sort of like folk element to them, but they're so like visually realistic and gripping and gritty that when the supernatural elements and just the psychological tension between the characters starts to come up, it just seems to like, I don't know, it just makes everything more vivid in relief. I've really been a fan of his movies so far.
It works so well in The Witch because you're straining to hear half of what's being said because the dad just like whisper mumbles all of his lines.
Yeah, and it's like that sort of like Puritan English.
It's very old-timey, and the music is like super tense, but also like extraordinarily loud compared to the dialogue. So it's constantly throwing you off and like making you feel very uneasy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of drone and like these keening kind of insect sounds in the woods all around them and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the music does the heavy lifting of the horror in that movie. But it's all just it's a really interesting horror piece. Like I find myself being drawn to horror movies like Midsommar,
Yeah.
where it's not traditional horror, but it just kind of like gets under your skin and you just can't stop thinking about it after for a really long time.
Yeah, it's much more, yeah, I mean Hitchcocky, and like none of this is slashery, even the little, you know, the gory parts that come up here or there. It's not the kind of movie that, you know, for people who are sensitive about that kind of stuff, or just, I mean, I'm not a big fan of like slasher movies at all. Never really cared for much of that, other than like Nightmare on Elm Street when I was a kid. Was into that, but yeah, it's just the kind of thing that like worms into your brain and you keep thinking about and just it just bothers you. It gives you bad dreams and yeah.
It does. It just unsettles you. It's ugh.
Yep,
Ugh.
absolutely.
Anyway, but it wasn't her first role, I don't think, but it was absolutely her breakout role.
It was her first movie.
Was it really?
Yeah, she'd never done anything else before. She'd been in like a kid show, I think, and done some voice work. That was it.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and she just has to go through like so many crazy emotions, because if people haven't seen this movie, I mean, it has like a little bit of like Salem witch trial type action where the accusations start flying as all these horrible supernatural events start happening kind of subtly around the outskirts of this little community that they've built for themselves after leaving kind of the Plymouth colony. They kind of go off on their own and are living out, you know, way in the middle of like, you know, mid 1600s New England with nothing around, on the brink of this gigantic, you know, ancient primordial forest. And yeah, darkness ensues. And yeah, she just gives like just like the most intense, amazing performance. And the final two scenes of that movie will just stick with you forever. Like you'll just
Oh,
n you'll
yeah.
never be able to get over it. I mean, I don't know how many people I've wanted to ask, you know, the question to, you know.
Would thou like to live deliciously?
Yeah, wouldst thou like to
Would
live
thou like the
deliciously?
taste of butter?
Yes, back then,
Oh.
butter was the jam, apparently.
So creepy.
Black Philip the Goat. But yeah, she's you know, she was great in that, and then I saw her in a movie called Thoroughbreds, which is sort of like a dark, even like creepier, like rich girl version of Heathers.
Oh, nice. I've heard really good things about it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah,
It's
that's.
her and it's this other actress that
Yeah, Olivia
I
Clark.
quite liked in some.
Or Olivia
I saw her in
Cook.
like an absolutely terrible rom-com on Netflix, but she was really like really good.
Yeah, she's really intense. Like she puts out a lot. You know, you definitely get the sense of intelligence and all this stuff boiling beneath the surface with her. And then yeah, I think that was Anton Yelchin's final movie, like final appearance in a movie as well, as sort of like the creepy drug dealer that these two kind of rich girls lure into their web to do their bidding. And he's great in that too, as sort of like, you know, trying to be the tough guy. And basically just sort of like this hapless loser character. So yeah, she's in that. And then yeah, it was Emma this spring. Was the one where that kind of reminded me, where I was just like, oh yeah, Anya Taylor-Joy is super good. Like she just like I you wouldn't have, I after seeing everything else she'd been in, like you wouldn't have thought that she could do comedy and sort of like snark and like biting wit and all these sort of like fraught looks at with people, and like she pulls off that physical comedy all through it
and
so well.
Romance and yeah, all of those aspects. I've watched Emma like at least twice since it came out, and it was one of the few movies this year that I was like, yes, I will pay $20 to see this movie.
Yeah.
It's tremendous. Like, everything about that movie is so, so good. The performances, the visual. Like, if you're a fan of any of Sofia Coppola's work,
yeah,
which is very, like, pastel and, like, it's like eating soft cakes on a Sunday afternoon, the way she puts things into perspective. It's not a Sofia Coppola movie, but it's very similar vibe.
Yeah, like, just a really, really strong visual style. And yeah, the director has been, like, Autumn de Wilde has been one of the best, most recognized, like, rock photographers for, you know, 30 years.
Costumes are so tremendous. And, yeah, like, some of the most accurate to period that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, I've watched YouTube videos talking about the accuracy of detail and everything that goes into the costumes. It's just amazing.
Yep. And, you know, as someone who read Emma when I was probably, like, 11, when I was kind of going through the, like, okay, I'm going to read all the classics, like, I don't remember the book perfectly well, but one thing I'd say is that, like, almost every Jane Austen adaptation I've ever seen in movies has sort of had that feel of, like, you're looking into the past and things are sort of muted and a little bit, like, sepia, and the characters mm-hmm. don't seem particularly lively. Like, they just, you know, they all seem like they're in a museum rather than that you've been taken to the time period and watching people, in bright color that they actually had at the time, like, be human, you know, within the confines of, you know, the social structures and all the manners and, yeah, the dress and everything like that.
The 2005 Pride and Prejudice is very lively. Like, it feels very of its moment. It's beautiful. It's really, really well done.
Is that the Keira Knightley one?
That's the Keira Knightley one.
That was fairly good, yeah.
Who directed that? Joe Wright directed that. And he's done, I think, Atonement and The Darkest Hour and the Hannah movie. So he definitely has, I think, a good sense of color and turning old style things into new. I really liked that one.
But yeah, you know, there's just so much, like, wit and sort of, like, you know, diva-ish, you know, behavior in those books that might not come across as on the printed page and almost never seems to get translated, you know, into the movie versions. And that was what I thought they just accentuated that and heightened it just enough in the 2020 version of Emma to just really make the whole thing, like, vivid and pop. And it just has, an amazing supporting cast as well. Like, Bill Nighy is in that, Miranda Hart, there's
Bill
a whole bunch.
Bill Nighy is just tremendous.
Like, yeah.
Just chewing up scenery in every single part of the movie he's in. He's just so good.
Yeah, so fun to watch, do just about anything. And then the other revelation in that, because I was already just, like, obsessed with Anya Taylor-Joy, but Johnny Flynn. Like, amazing Mr. Knightley in that movie.
Have you ever watched, it was originally called Scrotal Recall, but Netflix changed the title to Lovesick, which is less fun, because the entire construct of the show is that a guy finds out he has, like, a non-scary venereal disease and, like, has to call all of his last relationships
to
let them know.
Oh, wow. And what a concept.
It's so good, though. Like, it's very, very British, so it's, like, very funny and charming, and the entire thing is how he's in love with his female best friend and she's clearly in love with him, and you're kind of just going through his past relationships high fidelity style, but because of this terrible thing. I super recommend it if you can find it. It's so good. But he was the lead in that, and so that's where I found him originally, and I really liked him in that.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm just familiar with his music, you know, and not real well familiar with it. Johnny Flynn is kind of like a indie, like an indie acoustic singer songwriter in England, and, you know, kind of with, like, a strong bent toward, like, folk music and folk songs, you know, in, like, the English tradition. And kind of mixes that stuff into his music. So I kind of was familiar with him from that. But yeah, I mean, that was, Emma was the first thing I'd seen him in. And yeah, the way he and Anya Taylor-Joy kind of go at each other and kind of bring out the fact that he's, they just brought it out much more strongly that you see that he's in love with her earlier than you might would in anything else. And, you know, and you can kind of see what a mess he is as well. And that movie, the way they film that, there's just so, the layering is just so great, because every time you go back and watch it, you start to see like, oh, that, yeah, okay, that person, if you didn't know the story, like, oh, that, oh, okay, wait a minute, I see where Jane Fairfax is staring at Frank Churchill and they're looking at each other for just that brief moment. You know, they're just like the architecture of looks and gesture in that movie is just all so, you know, richly composed. It's really just a treat. And, you know, and probably a lot of our baseball listeners aren't big Jane Austen fans. I hate to stereotype, but maybe, you know,
they should
consider
satirists of society of her era.
Yeah. I mean, I read her and I think like even a lot of dudes that I grew up with who read a lot of books and were into literature, like there's still kind of this like idea that Jane Austen is like chick lit when in reality she's like the first great psychological novelist who like really explored like the concepts of people like sublimating their emotions, you know, overcompensating, you know, for their feelings or muting their feelings because they're scared, you know, for them to be realized. And I mean, she's absolutely fantastic. And yeah, I just felt like this adaptation more than anything else, like let all that breathe really well. Because when you look at that story in retrospect, you see that for all Emma's meddling and queen bee-ishness, he's exactly the same guy, but just in the guy sense. He's the one who's like getting the gossip everywhere and going and visiting everybody's houses at night and, you know, trying to work, you know, for his boy, the farmer, to get Harriet Smith. And, you know,
yes. Yeah,
I mean, he's working the same forces in the background and just giving her no end of shit for her meddling and stuff like that. And it's all just because he can't just come out with it.
So delightful. And that, I mean, we could talk about Emma forever, but I think the thing that most people saw her in, of course, this year.
Yeah, this is why we decided to talk about her.
Was Queen's Gambit, which, like, when that hit Netflix, I'm like, excuse me, Anya Taylor-Joy is in a TV show?
Yeah.
I guess I'll try watching it.
About chess? Yeah.
Yeah, about chess. Okay. And I watched the entire thing over 2 days.
Yeah, so did I.
I'm almost ready to rewatch it because I loved it that much. But oh God, it was funny because I watched that and I watched Cobra Kai for the first time in the same weekend.
Yeah.
Over Halloween. And oh, what a great weekend for TV. Oh, and notably, if we're talking about British comedy, I also watched the series called The Duchess.
Oh, yeah.
Same weekend, which is very much in the Fleabag vein of hard to like heroines, so if you don't like slightly cringy self-comedy, avoid at all costs, but I loved it. So that was a great weekend for TV.
And really, Emma kind of fits into that as well. Like, yeah, the character, who, you know, and that, to finish with Emma, the great thing about that is that, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow is just sort of muted, and it's and not, just not that expressive, or it's just hard to even imagine, like, Gwyneth Paltrow having, like, a sharp tongued, like super witty, like bitchy side. She's just sort of like, you know, kind of like lukewarm in all these ways. Whereas in Emma, like Anya Taylor-Joy plays her like kind of, you know, kind of a slightly, you know, well, not even slightly, like a stuck up kind of snobby little rich girl who runs her little social circle. And then you get, and because you see her in her unlikable self, it's just so much more satisfying when you see like the person change and come through all these realizations about, you know, about all the ways that they were, you know, foolish and naive about, you know, about all their little plans and what they thought they could do and about their own emotions and how it was all just, you know, kind of to hide their own decisions that they didn't want to make.
It's definitely worth noting that the best Emma adaptation before this was Clueless.
Yeah. Yep. And they did reference that. I saw in one interview, like they were talking about, yeah, they wanted it to be more like, you know, to kind of have more of that Clueless type vibe to it.
Yeah. Cause Amy Heckerling's Clueless is such a good adaptation of Emma. And I don't think people realize that it is.
Yeah.
But like 100% it's Emma. And if you've seen Emma and then watch Clueless, you get all of it because it's all there. I mean, Elton, every part of it is absolutely flawlessly executed. and so this, I was excited to see one that was like closer to the book. But like truly awesome, awesome, both of them.
Yep. But yeah, but then yeah, the Queen's Gambit, of course, probably if you're listening to this, that might be the thing that you've seen Anya Taylor-Joy in, because it just blew up and became like the biggest, you know, show on Netflix maybe of all time, at least as far as like a limited series goes. And people are buying chess boards left and right, and then chess clubs are going crazy, and there's like, you know, just infinite YouTube videos of people talking about it and like playing out the chess games, and all the you know, the chess glitterati are all buzz and all that. But it just had, it was just such a flawlessly composed show. Like, it just seemed to do everything well. Like, you know, the staging, the humor, there was just so much humor that was not like forced in any way, that kind of kept leavening the situation, even in the bleaker parts early on, when it, you know, when they're in the orphanage and they've got the kids on drugs and they can't do anything. And, you know, Mr. Scheibel, the janitor, is actually like, you know, pretty scary at first. You know, there's kind of that darkness, but they play with it. Like the scene where she steals all the pills is, you know, like horrifying, but also kind of hilarious in its own way. It's like a little caper of its own within what's going on. And so it just has so many nice tones to it like that. And the relationships that unfold, you know, you kind of are waiting for like things to be, someone to be terrible to her, or for something really bad to happen.
Yeah.
And it's just like real life stuff that plays out. You know, it's not like, you know, one super dramatic moment. It's just that it's a biopic, really. And that's why I think so many people come away from that thinking it's a true story. Because
it feels very real.
Yeah.
Like it does feel like she was a real person. And I think that kind of goes to the director, and it goes to Anya's performance. And it's just like, you feel that Beth has the complexity and the depth of a real person.
Yeah. 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 She has all these flaws, and a lot of the things that you like most about her, like the fact that she's sort of spiky, and like right from the beginning, when the girls at school are like, oh, your clothes suck and you're a weirdo. And she's immediately like, oh yeah, well fuck you, Margaret, you know?
Yeah.
And just kind of shocks them all. Like, she has this sort of like tough exterior of a girl who grew up in an orphanage, and also like a little bit like, we throw around like, you know, like autism like casually too often, but she has a little bit of that where she can't read people. She thinks logically, and she doesn't, you know, isn't following along with the emotions of the people around her, which often leads to like funny conflict as well.
Yeah, very much like scenes where like she'll hook up with a guy and then just go back to reading her chess books, and he's like, like, should we cuddle? And she's just like, I don't care, do whatever you want.
Yeah, whatever you want. Oh, and the scene where she like, you know, purposely goes with this college dude, like, I'm gonna lose my virginity tonight, you know, like, all right, this guy will have to do. And then, you know, afterward, when she's just like, yeah, okay, well, that wasn't what I was hoping it was, and she just like pats him on the shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay, nice try. Oh my god.
That'll do.
Yeah, yeah. I am sure you gave it your best shot. Yeah. Yeah, she just, yeah. You know, there's like that commandingness to her. She never sort of devolves into like, you know, the cliches that they would like to force on females in those kinds of situations, you know, like, you know, after school movie type crap that, you know, they often feel obliged to put in there. Like, she's in charge of almost everything that happens to her, you know, and it's her own internal demons that are, you know, form all the conflict in the show, other than like the, you know, the couple ace chess players that she's got to take down along the way.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because like, she's the kind of character I think that could be unlikable, because she's kind of cold and aloof. She's obviously struggling with like not only demons but like, you know, addiction.
Yeah.
And she's never made to be less of the heroine.
Yeah.
Like, in spite of her flaws, or even because of them, she still is somebody that you like root for, which I think is something you rarely get to see in like a female driven movie like that, where like she's never made the villain of her own story.
Yep. Or and she doesn't really need to be rescued either, you know?
Exactly. Like, she doesn't need a man to sweep in and save her. At the end, it's not a man at all who comes to like pick her back up. It's a friend, and it's a woman. And I think that like that final act of that show is just sensational.
Yeah, where she kind of finally comes to understand that she does have, you know, all these people around her, and that it's her that's kind of built all the walls, and not just the tough circumstances that she's been through with her mother dying, you know, and then being in the orphanage, and then being, you know, adopted by this really weird couple. But you know, luck of luck, it turns out okay because the dad just leaves and she and, you know, her new momish mom, you know, have like this really sweet, you know, fairly deep and sophisticated relationship that forms, you know, really quickly, where they, you know, they sort of support each other and, you know, like help each other each sort of have part of their dream, you know, and her mom before, you know, the end of her life kind of gets to have like this fun and this adventure before, you know, before her drinking and kind of, you know, depression over the stiltification of the, you know, mid 50s, 60s housewife lifestyle, finally kind of does her in. But yeah, that relationship was great. All the relationships were just so good. And yeah, I mean, as an actress, she just has like these weapons because she has like these, you know, somebody described her as like some kind of like, you know, alien elf from the future. Like her face doesn't look like, she's mm-hmm. incredibly beautiful, but you've just sort of never seen anyone who quite looks like that. Like she's, yeah, she looks like she was born to play, you know, Galadriel's daughter in, yeah, as Stephen Colbert was freaking out about in an interview I saw with her, because I am obsessed and have seen every interview with this person and need to sort of step back. But I mean, yeah, once in a while I do just get absolutely obsessed with an actor or an actress, and I have to know everything about them, and I am definitely there with her.
Well, you know, my favorite story of the filming of Queen's Gambit is that scene with her playing with the young child, the Russian prodigy.
Yeah.
And in that scene where she keeps wandering around and going to the other side of the room and like stalking around and watching him, all of that was improvised.
Yeah, she just did all that.
She told the director, she's like, what if I just like pace? And he's like, yeah, go to town. And they just didn't tell the kid.
Yeah.
So she would just get up from the table and like walk across the lobby and then come back and play her move and walk away. And I thought it was really neat to watch how it unsettled him.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah. She just kind of, yeah. Didn't she say like, can I just intimidate this kid, you know, the way Beth would? And yeah. And just like going and sitting down and then just like tapping her foot while just staring at him with these giant eyeballs and freaking him out.
So good.
Yeah, one of the things that I have thought has been the coolest about her career is that she just has picked so many good parts. Like I've, you know, she was in Split. You know, a lot of people didn't recognize her at first because she had dark hair in that movie, but she held her own against James McAvoy in like in an absolute kind of batshit psychological thriller in that movie
James
too.
McAvoy's.
Yeah, 19 different James McAvoys, and it just seems like
that movie.
And it just seems like she's found like people who really let her just collaborate with them, you know, like she's picked good scripts and worked with good people. And it's been interesting to hear her talk about, you know, like the points where she was able to just be like, no, we're doing it this way, you know, and where the directors have really kind of asked her input and sort of let her into it. She just seems to have a lot of, a lot of good, like good taste, but also like really good sense for like picking who to work with. And so like the point of all this is that even before Queen's Gambit, I've just been like, this girl's going to be a huge star. This, you know, at what point is everyone going to wake up and then go back and watch all of these other good movies that she made before everybody kind of knew who she
was?
And then
it was like 4 months later.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden the Queen's Gambit came out and it was like, oh, holy cow, here we go. All right. So yeah. Good luck out there, Annie Taylor-Joy. And be ready because yeah, you're going to be recognized now. And then, like, now you got
to
deal with it.
To take the Charlize Theron role in the prequel for Furiosa.
Yep.
The Mad Max Fury Road prequel, which, I mean, I'm hesitant to be excited about because Mad Max Fury Road is absolutely my favorite movie of all time.
You know, I just watched that. As a result of her getting that role, I finally was like, you know, you never did go see Mad Max Fury
you
Road.
You never saw it before?
No, I never did, and it was awesome. I mean, it was awesome, for sure.
That movie is the closest I've come to thinking, am I having a heart attack?
Yeah, well,
because
Tom Hardy.
Adrenaline.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that movie is so good.
Another person who, and I don't know, maybe like some young people are listening to this. Like, and if you don't know this already, like a great way to go about like finding new movies, new music is to like look for like who produced this music or who directed this movie, or, you know, if this person keeps showing up in good projects, you know, go look up their IMDb page and go watch everything else that they did. I mean, there are chains, like the people who are the best in their fields, like seem to find each other and create these chains. And like Tom Hardy, obviously I've never seen Tom Hardy be anything less than absolutely fucking brilliant in anything.
Phenomenal. He's a powerhouse. And I honestly don't think that Tom Hardy gets the respect he deserves as an actor just because he happens to be like buff and pretty.
Yeah.
Like,
but he's also, but he's like, you know, and he has that, but he's also like sort of ugly. Like he's not like pretty, pretty. Okay. He's so, not pretty. He's like your type of pretty because he looks like he could have been a catcher.
He fits the niche of Ashley's type of attractive man, which is entirely, does he look like he killed somebody once? There's two. One is, does he look like he's a big fan of Chicago sports teams? Which I feel like every woman who lives in Illinois understands exactly what I'm talking about. And the other...
Yeah. Well, guys out there will also know what I mean. Well, and girls will also know what I mean about Chicago girls as well. But okay, go ahead.
And then the other, well, I mean, like, just picture Jason Kipnis if you're not sure what I'm talking about when I say dudes who look like they like Chicago sports. Because he's from Illinois, and he's exactly what I mean. But then, yeah, there's guys that just look like they've been beat up a couple times, and they might have been, like, a semi-pro boxer when they were younger. That is,
yeah.
And Tom Hardy absolutely fits into that. Yeah. But did you see the movie he did where it was just him in his car?
No. Nope.
Oh, God, what was that called? Hold on, I'm going to look it up, because it's sensational.
I've missed him in a few things in the past, too. Like, at first, somehow, I didn't realize he was the foil in The Revenant until, like, the end. And that,
oh, yeah. Walk is the name of the car movie. The entire thing, and, like, Olivia Colman is in it, but has just her voice.
Ah, interesting.
And he's just driving, and it's him kind of with his whole world unraveling as he has conversations with his wife, and with a woman he cheated on his wife with, who's now pregnant, and, like, this entire, like, sticky mess he gets himself into.
Yeah.
But the whole movie is just him and a cell phone in a car.
Oh, interesting.
Like, talk about carrying the entire thing by yourself. It's unbelievably good.
What's that movie about the dude who's in the... well, I shouldn't even get into this one, but there's a movie... I want to say it's, like, Jake Gyllenhaal or something, where he's in a phone booth, and a sniper targets him, and the entire movie is him being trapped in this phone booth, unable to call for help. And like,
phone booth?
Yeah.
Colin Farrell?
Oh, Colin Farrell, that's who it is. Yeah, okay. It was fairly forgettable, but yeah.
Yeah, it's him and Kiefer Sutherland is the guy that's the
yes. shooter. Yeah, there you go. Yep. Yeah.
I remember that movie.
But yeah, I mean, Tom Hardy, awesome. And then so... Anya Taylor-Joy led me, her getting the Furiosa role led me to see that. And then Johnny Flynn led me to go watch Beast about 2 weeks ago. And Beast is a hell of a movie from about 2 years ago. It's him and Jessie Buckley. And Jessie Buckley, I don't know if you know who she is. She's in the new Charlie Kaufman movie, I'm Thinking About Ending Things. Which I also now need to see because she is fucking incredible in this movie. But basically, she's like the outcast of her sort of rich upper class family. And Johnny Flynn, and this is on the Isle of Jersey off of England. And Johnny Flynn is sort of like this poacher, handyman, like mysterious character who she meets. And he sort of takes her away from this rich, stilted life. But there are murders taking place all over the island, and it keeps going.
This is a real story. The Beast of Jersey is a real story.
Well, yeah, it's only loosely based on it, though. But yeah, he plays the character that, you know, you're not sure who it is until they actually find the murderer, and it just goes in back and forth. But Jessie Buckley, in particular, in that movie, is just bananas good, because she's kind of having a breakdown and trying to, like, you know, she's falling in love with this guy, but she's also terrified of him. And, like, everybody she knows is telling her that they think it's, you know, he's the killer. And there's just so many great scenes. I mean, it's just another, like, super intense, you know, slightly skin-crawling, at points, just because of what the emotional, like, and psychological damage that is going on in that movie is really intense. But that movie was good. Yeah.
By the way, if you're true crimey, like I am... Google Beast of Jersey with extreme caution.
Yeah. Yeah.
That guy wore the scariest fucking mask I think I've ever seen.
Yep. That is a particularly terrifying one. I would agree.
yeah, I'm sorry, I re-googled that. That's gonna take me to bed tonight. Oof.
And then finally, and I want people to know real quickly, like, I do watch popular movies, I do read popular books, but we don't talk about that because people, you know, by and large, will find that stuff by themselves. So the fun is, like, the slightly indie stuff that maybe y'all didn't hear about. So I also have to hit on Black Bear, because I am an Aubrey Plaza fanatic as well. I'm absolutely obsessed with Aubrey Plaza. I love that woman. She's hilarious. She's just great in everything she does, and just is so willing to, like, commit to something and just take it to absurdity. Like, you just see the improv training in her, even in, like, all the interviews. And there are huge compilations of her talk show interviews, because she's a psycho in those, and in the best possible way. And But she gives, like, another one of just, like, amazing performance in Black Bear. And it's sort of this meta movie where she's a director and she tries to go on this retreat to this cabin in upstate New York, because she just can't write and she's feeling blocked and all that. And this couple who used, you know, one of them's a musician, the husband, and the wife is a dancer, and she's pregnant, and they're, you know, they didn't really have that much success with their art, and so they've moved out to this place and bought it, and they're going to turn it into a retreat, you know, and that's kind of how they're going to make their living. But she has, like, just a knack for button pushing from the beginning with them, and it sort of plays off of, like, Aubrey Plaza's, like, actual, like, persona, at least, like, a little bit of, like, the April Ludgate and, and, you know, and the interview persona with her. And the way, like, the three of them, like, the toxicity of the relationship that comes between those three characters all in the course of one night is super intense, and just leads to this, like, absolutely, like, shattering scene. And then the movie completely switches, and now they're actually making the movie, but they're all in different roles now. And so you watch the whole thing unfold, like, from a completely different perspective as the movie being made of that first part. And in the second part, Aubrey Plaza gives an even crazier, like, more intense, like the most intense, like, you know, your palms are clammy, like you're watching Free Solo, you know, and just freaking out. Like, I had to, like, keep turning it off and walking away, and you couldn't look away. But you couldn't, you know, you couldn't give up on it either, because it was just so goddamn intense. Like, she has the most intense, like, 20-minute, like, breakdown in a movie I think I've ever seen. And just, like, confirmed for me what I always knew, which is that she just has more balls than anybody, will push things, like, so far, has so much guts. And I wish people would get over the April Ludgate, like, slacker stuff, because I do think she's one of the best actresses out there, and I wish she was getting, like, the big time roles. And so hopefully that will finally start happening for her. I know the movie kind of got swamped by, you know, COVID and the fact that it's a weird art movie in its way, but holy shit, was she great in that.
So, like, two things about that. The guy that plays the husband in that movie, because I haven't seen
Christopher Abbott.
IMDb. Yeah, Christopher Abbott.
Yeah.
That guy's poised. Like, he's going to be something.
Yep.
He's going to be the next takeoff from the girl's legacy. Like, Adam Driver is the guy right now, but, like, Christopher Abbott's, like, really quietly very good.
Yeah. He is great in that.
And he's been in such interesting roles. And I think that he's really going to have a breakout at some point soon. He's getting there, and I think he's just really talented. And speaking of Aubrey Plaza, she... Happiest Season was amazing, by the way, and that movie ended the wrong way.
Yeah, everybody believes that, yeah.
She absolutely... It should have been Kristen Stewart and... Aubrey Plaza at the end. That's the only thing that makes any sense.
I would love to see Kristen Stewart and Aubrey Plaza together. That sounds great. I didn't see that movie, but I couldn't help avoid the litany of rage about the fact that, yeah, they didn't end up together in that movie.
It was the wrong move, but anyway, it's a good movie, and it's fun, though. It would be nice to see, like, a lesbian Christmas movie that isn't so wrought with personal dramas. But she was in, Aubrey Plaza was in this really funny sex comedy called The
To-Do List. Oh, yeah.
Which is from 2013, and it's very much like high school senior realizes she's done absolutely nothing except she's fairly much like Booksmart, right? Where, like, yeah, she realizes she hasn't done anything or had any fun or had any personal experiences, so she's, like, checking things off of a sexual to-do list over the course of a summer.
Yeah, before she goes to college. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's, like, got this incredible cast with Bill Hader and a bunch of other people. Hold on, let me...
Oh, the girl from... Oh, no.
It's a great list. Like, it's
the girl from Broad Street. What's her name?
Alia Shawkat.
Yeah.
Is in it. Rachel Bilson is in it. Christopher Mintz-Plasse. Andy Samberg. Donald Glover. Adam Paley.
Yeah, Donald Glover. That's right.
Connie Britton's her mom. Like,
yeah.
It's really good and really cute and funny and kind of charming.
Yep. And kind of a turnaround. Such a turnaround on the, like, you know, the boy virgin has to get laid, you know, in his last year of high school type movie, like, completely subverts the entire thing. And
definitely do a double feature one night of The To-Do List and Booksmart, which are two of the, like, funniest, most charming, like, girl wants to lose her virginity before college type tropes. I think it'll be good.
Yeah. And, you know, She's been good in pretty much everything. Ingrid Goes West was weird and good. Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates was kind of just stupid, but it had its moments. But yeah, and then Legion. Like, I don't know who else.
So weird.
I don't know who else could play that character, the demon in Legion, because what's required of it is just so absolutely batshit crazy, and it just changes, like, seductress and, like, maniac, and then, like, sweet innocent, and, like, just, like, every gamut of emotion and you know, character and stuff throughout that thing. And yeah, I mean, she can just do it all. I mean, the woman is super talented. And, you know, the thing about The To-Do List is I get the feeling that Aubrey Plaza was that girl, because whenever you listen to her talk about, like, her childhood, she was, like, president of all the clubs, and, you know, it was, like, really popular and, like, a really good student, but also just a complete kind of weirdo under the surface. And at some point, the weirdo, you know, really came out, and that's what everyone latched onto. But she's a really smart, overachiever type person underneath the, yeah, whatever slacker vibe there still is there. Yeah. And I know people want her to play Daria, but I personally think she's way past that, and it would only kind of lock her into that crap again.
Yeah, another fun one, if you haven't seen it, is Safety Not Guaranteed, which is, like, the weird time travel one with her and Jake Johnson, who's, like, Nick Miller.
That's such a cool little movie, yeah.
Yeah, and it's got Mark Duplass, who I love. Colin Trevorrow directed that?
Yeah, the guy who went on to do the latest Jurassic Park,
Jurassic
right?
Jurassic World.
Yeah, Jurassic World, yeah. Yeah, I think that was the movie that got Steven Spielberg to pick him. Yeah, Safety Not Guaranteed. Another really, like, cool little indie movie, yeah.
Kind of weird that the next thing he did after Safety Not Guaranteed was Jurassic World. Wow.
Yeah, you think about the difference in budget in those two movies. Because Safety Not Guaranteed looks like, you know, almost like a very well-made student film. And
deeply indie.
Yep, and then all the way to Jurassic World. All right, and then to jump off from this Anya Taylor-Joy into all these other topics, one more is that Tom Hardy in Peaky Blinders, amazing. Elfie Solomons, I don't know if you've watched Peaky Blinders. Don't you like Cillian Murphy? You probably do.
I do. I liked him a lot earlier in his career, like stuff like 28 Days Later.
Okay.
Like up to probably like Batman, those ones were more my Killian phase.
Okay.
I found the character in Peaky Blinders that he plays to just be so cold.
Yeah.
That it's really hard to, like, feel attached to him.
Yeah, and it doesn't loosen up that much, like, in seasons like 3, 4, and 5. It starts to, but and you see a lot more of him and, like, more of, like, what he was like before the war and before, you know, all that trauma and stuff like that. Yeah. But that's just such a amazing conception of a show. That's just such a historical timepiece that you wouldn't really think about as all the dudes who fought in the trenches coming home. And obviously, like, that would include, like, J.R.R. Tolkien, who turned his experiences, you know, into a whole, you know, different, you know, realm, like, went to the fantastic and the mythic rather than the gritty, you know, street violence of Manchester. But man, I love me some Peaky Blinders. There's a lot of Nick Cave music. There's a lot of PJ Harvey music. The whole thing just feels like it was made for me in the late 90s. Like, I am ready to dye my hair black again. watching that show. But Tom Hardy's in that, and he plays an amazing character in that. And then who shows up in season 5 but Miss Taylor-Joy again?
Well, what I noticed is that the second Queen's Gambit started being popular, they changed the header image for Peaky Blinders to a picture of her.
Yep.
So that people would be like, did you know?
Well, wait a minute.
I did not, but I stopped watching that show after season 2, so.
Yep. But the whole thing is just so interesting to watch happen to an actress, because I've seen it happen so many times with bands, because, you know, there's just been so many bands that I was into and loved their first couple albums, and then they finally have this hit, and then you see everybody, like, you know, turn around and go backwards throughout their whole career. And yeah, it kind of feels like that's going to happen with Anya Taylor-Joy as far as movies go and TV. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch that happen and see what else comes from it. She just got done filming the Norseman, which is Robert Eggers' third movie, which is probably going to come out late next year. And I think that's got like Ethan Hawke and Alexander Skarsgård and Nicole Kidman, but it's some kind of like Icelandic Viking, you know, murder mystery thriller. And to think about the dude who did The Witch and The Lighthouse doing a movie like that just sounds like fucking awesome. Like I can't wait for that. So I'm stoked for that one as well.
The Northman, is that the one?
Yeah.
Now I'm looking at this. Ooh.
I think the Norse.
I've never heard of this. It's called The Northman.
Oh, is it Northman?
According to IMDb, yeah.
Oh, okay. Northman. All right.
Ethan Hawke, Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe. Yeah, again, yeah.
I mean, if you've seen The Lighthouse, ugh.
Yeah. Oh, Willem Dafoe. So nice to see him getting all these props late in his career. He's done so many great things.
I thought you liked my lobster. Oh, my God, that's...
Some of the speeches. Oh, my God, the speeches he gives in that...
The two major monologues in that movie are the ones where he yells about making dinner, and the one where Robert Pattinson is just outraged about how bad Willem Dafoe smells.
Yep. The farts.
Oh, God. If you haven't seen The Lighthouse, I don't know if I want to say watch it, because it's very much for a very specific audience.
Yeah, you have to be able to handle, like, being very unnerved and uncomfortable. And actually, just about every movie that we've mentioned here have some elements of that in play where I'm, like, naturally like wincing and want to stop, but I'm like super compelled as well, and that's kind of my favorite tension to be in a movie.
If you've never wondered, like, I wonder what a mermaid vagina looks like, or like what would happen if Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe were stuck on an island in black and white,
in Nova Scotia in the late 1800s,
it may not be the movie for you. but that said, it's very unnerving and weird, and you have very strong feelings about a seagull. And I saw it in theaters.
And don't look into the light. Yeah.
Yeah, don't look into the light. It belongs to him.
It belongs to him. Yeah.
I am the keeper of the light. Anyway, sorry. The Lighthouse is bonkers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Watching, if you don't mind feeling a little bit uneasy.
Yeah. So, you know, Uncle Brandon and Aunt Ashley have recommended all these movies for you guys now to go be super creeped out by, and, you know, you can compliment us and thank us profusely, or yell at us for giving you bad nightmares on Twitter, as usual. But I think we'll wrap it up now.
I think I laughed at you for the idea of us talking about Anya Taylor-Joy for 30 minutes, and we sure did just go for it.
Yeah, at least we splintered off into everything else rather than me, like, detailing every obsession with her facial features that I might have. So, because she is amazing looking. Yeah, there's just...
She's very unique looking. Absolutely.
And then you get the British accent, the Spanish, you know, the Argentine Spanish mixed in. Yeah, and it shifts. Like, whatever she's talking about or how excited she is, it gets more American. And when she's calmer, it's more English.
She was born in America and grew up part of her life in Argentina and then grew up the rest of her life in Britain. So it's a very, like, interesting mix.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And she's a smart gal. You can tell she's a big reader. So.
Oh, my God. Bjork is in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Bjork is in The Northman, too. Yes. What? Yes. And I'm going. And damn it, I'm going to Iceland. We were supposed to go to Iceland in October, and obviously COVID blew that all out of the water. We are going to go next October. So I expect to go to Iceland and have a crazy adventure for, you know, 10 days, driving around in a camper van, exploring the whole island by ourselves, and then come back, and then hopefully the Northman will hit right then.
Yes.
That would be ideal.
I like
it. Yeah. All right. We'll let it go from there. Next time we'll do books, maybe, and go through, like, everything that we read in quarantine, which could be a whole giant episode as well. So, I don't know, maybe we'll throw some of these extras in there where, you know, we're both big readers, we watch a lot of movies, and consume a lot of art and music and stuff, and so what the hell. We'll talk about that when we get chances as well.
Yes, a little bit over a long period. We've got lots to keep you busy.
Yeah, it's still a long winter to go, so... All right, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Hope you're all staying safe out there. Ashley, have a good evening, and we'll talk to you all later on.
Bye, guys.
Bye.